Hi, I'm Umushu.
And I'm Lindsay Claiborne, and you're listening to Beyond the Microscope.
Hi everyone, it's Lindsay and Mumu back for another round of Beyond the Microscope. Today we have Dr. Caroline Van Sickle, who is a biological anthropologist and the Wittig Postdoctoral Fellow in Feminist Biology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Hi Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start with a very simple question in that, what is it that you do?
What is it that I do?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, as an anthropologist, my focus is in paleoanthropology. So I spend a lot of my time looking at fossilized bones or casts of fossilized bones of our hominid ancestors to figure out what their anatomy can tell us about how humans evolved. And what I do at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is that I teach classes in the Gender and Women's Studies department that relate to topics of biology and gender. And right now I'm teaching a class called Human Evolution and Gender that goes through what we know about the fossil record and what assumptions paleoanthropologists have made in the past about gender of different hominin species and what that evidence actually is based, or what evidence that might actually be based on. So I teach and I do research.
How do you even, like, why that focus? I mean, did you go searching for a way to teach those kind of classes, or did that sort of fall, did that just fall in front of you?
It kind of fell in front of me. So I had come up with the idea for this particular class while I was still a graduate student and had no idea what I was going to do with the rest of my life. But I thought, you know, this would be a really cool topic to explore in a classroom setting. And so I kind of started making a syllabus already. And then at the time I was doing my dissertation on how Neanderthals gave birth, because this is a topic that we actually don't know much about but like to argue about a lot, even though the evidence is very sparse. And so I was already focused on parts of paleoanthropology that related to sex and gender, kind of, which is how I came up with the idea for the class. And so the University of Wisconsin's Center for Research on Gender and Women ended up getting an endowment to form a postdoc for feminist biology, and that was what they decided to call it. And I'm the first one to hold this position, and it was looking for a person who's really trained in some part of biology, so in my case, paleoanthropology, who wants to kind of spend 2 years exploring how to bring a more feminist theory sort of mindset into their work. And so the postdoc involves teaching to one class a semester for 2 years and pairing up with a lab on campus to do some work. So I'm affiliated with the anthropology department here as well. And it's been great. I've learned a lot.
So what kind of things do you talk about in this class?
So some of the stuff is we go back to some of the early days where it's Man the Hunter was a really big theory in like the 1960s. There was a whole symposium on it and a book came out of that where it was focusing on the importance of meat eating to how humans evolved and how our brain size increased. But it really was a theory that focused just on what male bodies were doing, and it assumed that any hunting behavior was being done by men. And this actually wasn't even supported by the other papers in the session that were looking at modern hunter-gatherers. But this became like the forefront idea that was really popular. And so when we cover this in my class, we read some of the initial literature on this, and we read some critiques that came out a few years later talking about, you know, when you look at different primates, you don't necessarily see this like stark sexual division of labor that we're predicting for fossil hominins. There are other ways to get protein that could have been important for meat eating when you had small group size, which is what we usually predict for early hominins, that we wouldn't necessarily predict that they would be sexually dimorphic in their behavior kind of thing. And so it just kind of goes through the critiques of this. And so then we have a nice class discussion where we talk about what is the fossil evidence? And so, you know, how do we recognize a male in the fossil record and how do we recognize a female? And what do we know about what their behaviors were? And so what does the archaeology look like and that sort of thing? And then we kind of talk through, okay, how much of a gendered interpretation can we give this? Or do we think that the authors were going too far? And in that case, usually they say too far.
Is this a new sort of area to study, or is this sort of just because of historical context and how scientists used to mostly be men and the people who did all this were always men and nobody really talked about it? Is it just sort of like finally people are talking about it, or is this really new research or new interpretations?
I think maybe a little bit of both, but the woman who left the money to the University of Wisconsin for my postdoc was a biologist who had actually no ties with the University of Wisconsin, but she had apparently heard about the Gender and Women's Studies Department and liked them, and so chose them to donate this money to, because she really felt that it was necessary to encourage women in science and people who were doing the kind of research that would encourage a more gender-fair perspective on things. And so I think some of it is just like we're kind of hitting that point in biology where there is suddenly enough diversity that we can have these kinds of discussions that weren't really there before. But in my own field of paleoanthropology, I would say that, you know, Man the Hunter was a book that came out in 1968, I think. And there were women right there who and men who were critiquing it, you know, immediately kind of thing. So it's not like it hasn't already been there, but it hasn't been as prominent. And I don't think there's very many classes like mine that are getting taught.
All right. So you mentioned Neanderthal birth.
Yes.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Dissertation topic.
I've been thinking about that since you mentioned it. I was like, now how, what, ooh.
Right. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work in that area and what we know and what we don't know?
Yeah.
How do Neanderthals give birth?
Well, that is an excellent question. And after writing an entire dissertation on the subject, I'm not totally sure I know the answer.
Oh, no.
I know. That's one of those. So the story with Neanderthals is that the first fossil hominin we ever found was a Neanderthal. So we have been studying them longer than we have any other hominin species. And they are recent enough and had possibly some cultural behavior that some of them were burials, that we actually have a pretty good record for Neanderthals. When we're talking about early Australopithecus species, you know, 3 or 4 million years ago, we're lucky if we have like one partial skeleton to go off of. That's like a really lucky find. But with Neanderthals, we have multiple skeletons that are fairly complete, often very well preserved. But for reasons that we're not really sure of why this is, most of them are male skeletons. So we actually don't have very much evidence for what female Neanderthals look like. There's some, but it's very fragmentary. It usually comes from sites that weren't burials. There's like one or two that they think might have been burials, but even those were not as well preserved as the males. And that isn't necessarily a bias. That might be just random sampling. Not everyone becomes a fossil. We don't find all of the fossils. So we're not really comfortable saying like, oh, Neanderthals, they were only burying their men or something like that. But that's also another possibility. And so when it comes to talking about childbirth, we are limited in the number of individuals we can use as evidence for this, because most of our sample is male. We have a really, really complete pelvis. So to understand childbirth, we have to look at the shape of the pelvis and understand how, and try and understand how a large-brained infant could fit through that. And Neanderthals have the same size brains as humans, and so they would have had the same large brain problem as we do. And so we know from looking at the most complete Neanderthal pelvis, which happens to be male, that they are very, that the males at least look very different than us. And so there actually have been predictions about how Neanderthals gave birth based on male pelvic remains, which is a little dubious.
How are they
not
different?
Great. So they're different in the sense that top part of the pelvis, so if you put your hands on your hips, that bone that you're touching is located a little more pushed back in the body than it is in humans. And it means that the front part of the pelvis, so like your pubic area where all your genitalia attach, is going to be expanded and stick out more in front. And so it just changes the posture that we would put the skeleton in, at least when we're talking about males. Now, when we look at the female skeletons for Neanderthals, we have way less to go on. So the most complete female Neanderthal pelvis that we have is one that by virtually reconstructing it and mirror imaging it, you have almost the front half of it is more or less complete. And so it has been reconstructed by different groups at different points in history. And each reconstruction looks totally different. And so we have some people saying that they had a really wide birth canal, and the problem they had giving birth was that the infant head actually probably wouldn't fit through because the infant head was more circle and the hole was more oval shaped. There's people who've reconstructed it to be pretty much the same kind of circle that we see for a birth canal in modern humans, that would have required a baby to rotate 3 times. And so it's something where just looking at this one individual, we don't really have an answer. We have different hypotheses on how we think birth could have happened, and nobody's really in agreement on this. And then you have the people who are looking at the male pelvis because it's more complete, weighing in on it, and it doesn't really give us a good idea of what birth was like in Neanderthals. So this is where I entered the ring. For my dissertation, what I did was I looked at all of the little tiny fragments of female Neanderthal pelvic bone that we had. This involved me actually identifying some of them as male and some of them as female. And really focusing on the tiny fragments that most people have ignored because they're tiny fragments. And so I took a bunch of measurements that I mostly developed myself as being measurements that relate to the shape of the birth canal, in the at least how it's framed by the bony pelvis, and that are ones that could be taken on at least 2 of the Neanderthals identified as female. I did some fancy statistics using resampling that allowed me to compare this small, very, very small, we're talking like 6 individuals, and often only 2 or 3 individuals per measurement, sample of Neanderthals to a larger sample of modern humans, and was able to find that indeed we do see differences in the pelvic dimensions of Neanderthal females versus modern humans. So I kind of was working under this idea that we think that pelvic shape is largely shaped by natural selection for, in humans at least, for us being bipedal and us being large-brained. And so in Neanderthals that are also bipedal and large-brained, there was kind of this idea that their female pelvis might actually look very similar to ours. And so the fact that the male pelvis, which we have better preserved evidence of, is different, might not actually mean anything for how they were giving birth. But it turns out it actually does. They look more like the male Neanderthals than they do like female modern humans. And so this suggests that birth isn't the only thing shaping pelvic dimensions in different hominins. And there's at least 2 different strategies for how a bipedal large-brained hominin could give birth. But in terms of the actual mechanics of it, I'm still a little foggy because they're very, very fragmentary. So I'm like,
there's only so much you can find out, right?
Exactly. So this is what I would predict. And so now if somebody goes out and finds a complete female Neanderthal pelvis, I will be able to say, ha, yes, see, it's exactly as I predicted. Or, oh, actually, I was wrong. Isn't that cool?
Well, so how likely is it? This might be an insane question, but what are the sort of likelihood of finding a complete Neanderthal female pelvis? I mean, is it just so rare, or you just have no idea?
It's a strange thing, because when I started grad school, I would be like, oh, it's super rare. There's no chance of this. But then while I was in grad school, actually one has been found. It's completely covered in a very hard breccia sort of rock right now. So we don't really know what it looks like. But preliminary CT scans of it suggest that it is a fairly complete pelvis, and it does appear to be female, and it is from a Neanderthal site. So it's something that, you know, maybe in like 5 years or so, when some poor grad student is done using a Dremel drill to like remove all of this rock from the actual bone, we might be able to do this. And the other thing is, ever since I've been involved with Rising Star, I think fossils are out there to be found. So I think it's probably less rare than we used to think.
So it's going to take that many years to remove all the rock away from the fossil?
It's a very time-consuming process, because the thing is, the fossil itself is a rock. Uh-huh. And so it's trying to very carefully distinguish which rock is the stuff you want to remove and which rock is the fossil itself. And so it's not something you do lightly. You do it very, very carefully, and it takes a lot of time. And then even once they're done with it, then they'll want to, the group that has spent so much time on this will want to be the ones to first publish on it and everything, which totally makes sense. And so I'm guessing it's probably going to be about 5 years before I'll have access to it.
I see.
Is the kind of thing.
I have a bit of a wonky question. Okay. Not that this hasn't been wonky. Never. Yet, right. all right. So we don't have many complete Neanderthal pelvises?
Okay. Pelvises or pelvises. Pelvises.
Right. Do we have other fossils from other hominid species?
We do. So the thing is, the overall sample size of individuals for other hominid species reduces drastically. Mm-hmm. That with Neanderthals, just looking at the skeletons that had any pelvic remains with them, we have over 30 individuals. And that's fairly rare. You compare this to, what's a good example? So the pelvic remains for Australopithecus africanus, there's like 3 individuals that are adults. And so order of magnitude lower kind of thing. And that tends to be more common. There's some species that, sometimes it depends how you're defining a species and which fossils you include in that. So you could get a larger sample with Homo erectus, but that one's a very geographically diverse sample, and a lot of people like to split that up into different species, which then, of course, reduces the overall sample size. And in a lot of the species, it's common to have at least one fairly complete female, at least one hip bone, maybe you won't have a sacrum kind of thing, and one fairly complete male, and then it's kind of hit or miss on the rest of it. But, and then of course you have species where like Lucy is Australopithecus afarensis, and we're fairly certain she's female. And she's like the most well-known one. See, this is the thing. This is what I think about all day is how do we really know if this is a female or if this is a male? So I start to sound very dubious on the whole thing.
There's so many like metaphysical levels of that. Well, if you spend all your day thinking about this, how did you wind up in this field in the first place?
So I took a biological anthropology class just as like a general ed class in undergrad, and found it really interesting. And so I signed up for an osteology class, and it was taught by this forensic anthropologist who was just fantastic in terms of had all sorts of stories to tell. I remember sitting in lecture one day, and he was talking about a case that he had been on where he was able to identify a victim as being a woman probably in her 40s or 50s who had spent most of her life wearing high heels because he could tell from the shape of her foot bones and how they had adapted to, when you're in high heeled position kind of thing. And he was able to tell all of this from the skeleton. And I just thought, that is fascinating. There's so many cool things you can do with this. And then I took his paleoanthropology class. And around that same time, I read, this is a little embarrassing, I read the book Clan of the Cave Bear by Jeanal.
I have read that.
It's a fantastic book, but I'm embarrassed to say that's actually how I got interested in Neanderthals, was reading about Ayla.
I understand
and her.
That.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah. So that was a combination of those was kind of what led me to do a little more research and decide to apply for graduate school and kind of go from there. And then once I got to graduate school, I got very interested in what is the story we're saying about female bodies and women in paleoanthropology and things like that, because you start taking classes in the stuff in more detail, and it's just such a man's world in terms of every fossil find is discovered by a man, it sounds like, and the ideas that they come up with and what they decide is the women in the past were doing is all very, oh, they were, just holding the babies while the men went out and did all of the other things. They were doing the hunting, they were doing the making tools, they were out exploring and finding new territory and doing all of this stuff. And it was just like, really? That's all the agency we're giving these hominids in the past? What are we really basing this on? I kind of had those ideas from like early days in graduate school and took a few classes that helped me get better at articulating them, or at least in theory, I've gotten better at it.
You mentioned Rising Star.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you, and we did talk to Jill, but I'd love to hear about your experiences on that whole project.
Yeah. So I first became aware of the Rising Star project when I was adjunct teaching a intro to bioanthro class at a very small liberal arts school in Georgia. Kind of middle of nowhere, Georgia, and I was teaching this class, and we'd actually already gotten done covering fossils, and I suddenly came across the Rising Star stuff on Twitter and was following it really, really closely and giving my students you know, daily updates on like, oh, they found this many fossils and they brought up a mandible yesterday. And, you know, Lee Berger sent back to Vits for more safes because they filled up the ones that they had, and all of these kinds of things. My students are just like, is this going to be on the test? I thought we were done with fossils. But I think some of them were a little more interested in it. I hope so anyway. And so that was my first interaction with it, was really just following the excavation on Twitter. I didn't know any of the people really yet. But it was just such a cool thing that you don't usually get to hear about excavations in that manner. And this was such an unusual excavation that it was really, really cool to kind of follow. And then around the time that I was actually applying for my postdoc, I saw the Facebook ad asking for early career scientists who had data that might be relevant to comparing to a potentially new hominin. So
no big deal, in other
words. Right, you know, and so obviously, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to, no, I immediately was like, I'm going to write a letter and apply for this, and then got around to telling my advisor about it, who was luckily very on board with it, as I was supposed to be finishing my dissertation at the time.
I mean, this is kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
It is, and he agreed, which was great, so I was very supported there. So yeah, I wrote them a letter and explained what my dissertation was about and how I was, you know, doing analyses on very fragmentary pelvic remains. And it turns out that's exactly what they needed. The fact that I was looking at Neanderthals wasn't particularly useful, because it turns out their the rising star fossils, the pelvic material doesn't look anything like Neanderthals. But it was all very, very fragmentary. So I got selected to be part of the Rising Star Workshop. And in May of 2014, I went down to Johannesburg and spent 5.5 weeks, and Jill was there, and we spent every day, we were all staying at the same hotel, we'd wake up in the morning and have breakfast together and talk about what the fossils looked like, we'd shuttle to campus and spend all day in the vault talking about what fossils looked like, you know, maybe take a break for lunch with some people, talk about what the fossils look like, we'd shuttle back to the hotel in the evening, we'd go to one of the like three dinner spots nearby, and stay at the bar late in the evening and that kind of thing, talking about what we thought the fossils were and how they got in the cave and what could this possibly mean. And then we'd go back to our rooms where we had roommates, and we would continue to talk about it while we got ready for bed. We'd fall asleep thinking about this, and we'd wake up the next day and do the whole thing over again. So we spent 5.5 weeks basically with that being the schedule. And it was a great experience that I got to lead the there was very many parts to the pelvis, and so I was on a team of people working on the kind of the whole torso. So we had a guy working on the rib cage and a guy working on the spine, and then I was working on the pelvis, and we were all collaborating with each other on how we thought these parts fit together. And it basically, so all of those parts, the torso really looks like something that resembles Lucy. It looks like something old. And so we thought for sure we found something old that's like, you know, this is some Australopithecus from like 4 million years ago. That's what we're looking at here. And after like the first 2 weeks, we had kind of assessed what we had in front of us. And so we started talking to the other tables and the other stations on what they had. And as soon as we talked to the foot team was nearest to us. And so it turns out Homo naledi has a foot that looks exactly like a human's. And they also have a lot of foot bones. I was very jealous of that. Then you go over to the cranial team and they tell you that, oh, you know, it definitely doesn't look anything like an Australopithecus. The teeth are totally wrong for that. And so you kind of go around the room to different skeletal areas and realize that actually the torso is the only thing that really does look anything like an Australopithecus. All the rest of the body parts look like either something early in our genus or something later in our genus, or possibly us. So that was kind of a...
That sounds so exciting.
So that was the whole realization that, okay, we found something new, because you don't usually see this mixture of traits found together like this. But it was pretty cool. That's a huge understatement. It was very cool.
When you had mentioned that when you looked at the pelvis for Naledi, it looked more like Australopithecus.
Mm-hmm.
What are the differences? Yeah, what does that mean? Like, how can you tell?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and I'm sitting here talking with my hands, which I realize does not help us any.
If only it were video!
Okay, so The main difference is that the top part of the pelvis is very flared in Naledi, just like the way it is in Lucy. And so it's basically, if you picture the top of the pelvis, so this is above the birth canal area, on a human as being kind of a bowl. And that's actually where the word for pelvis in other languages comes from. But in French, it's bassin. My French accent's terrible, but it basically means basin. And it's because the pelvis kind of forms like a bowl that holds all of your intestines in. Well, in Lucy and in a number of other Australopithecus species, including Africanus, which is a South African one, it's more like a saucer where those sides that would make up the wall of the bowl are kind of splayed out so that they're more flared and more and end up being much wider. And so it kind of totally changes what the direction is of the gluteal muscles that attach to the outside of that bowl. And so it affects what's going on with the leg and how things are attaching to the hips. And it's something that really throughout Australopithecus, we see this really wide form that's more like a plate. And then Sediba is a little weird because it starts to look more bowl-shaped. And then as soon as you get into the genus Homo, all of those early ones I said that we need to reassess kind of thing, they look like they would probably be more bowl-shaped. Neanderthals look like they would be more bowl-shaped. And then humans are like the extreme version where we have very steep walls on our bowl. And Homo naledi has a plate. It's like a very, very clear flat surface, and we only have like one fragment of it. It's a broken plate, but from that we can tell that it wouldn't have curved up and become a bowl. And so it is this like very different form.
That's really cool.
But I just fascinates me that you can sort of determine such gradations, which for the regular person who doesn't study this would be like, well, yeah, it's a pelvis, whatever. That you can determine that from
some of the stuff they'd be like, it's a bone?
Yeah, well, right. We're going one step past that one, please. But the idea that you can determine such specifics from a fragment or three, it's just fascinating to me.
And it is something that it takes time and practice. And like I said, I had spent a lot of time when I got down to South Africa already staring at small, tiny fragments of Neanderthal pelvic bone. So I was used to kind of understanding how the different parts of the bone should fit together. And so when I saw Homo naledi, it was totally different. I was able to recognize that pretty quickly. We had some other people on the project who were like the organizers and more the senior people, and they certainly know their osteology and, you know, if they know what to look for. But they hadn't really picked up on this. They had actually warned me that there wasn't going to be anything interesting to be said about the pelvis. Before I got down there, they're like, don't get your hopes up. There's a whole bunch of fragments, but they're not very useful. You're not going to be able to tell anything. And I walked in, and like the first day, I was like, whoa, look at this. And they're like, oh, yeah, I guess it is kind of flared, isn't it?
So, you're like, I'm so excited. You don't understand. Amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, it really does take someone who knows what to look for to get a chance to look at these. But it's great because now they're all scanned in online. So I'm not the only pelvic expert who's looked at this material at this point. And luckily, so far, nobody has said I'm wrong. So I'm like, okay, cool. We're doing well.
What new tech or new discovery or new something would, I mean, obviously you've been playing with new things for a couple of years now, but would just get you really excited or would just sort of change the game for you?
I have not taken any steps on in the direction of actually looking for this myself. So this very well may exist, but when I think about the evolution, and of course for me it's all evolution of the pelvis stuff, but also how that affects the posture of the skeleton overall. So I do think in terms of whole skeletons occasionally. I think of it in a way where it's like an animation in my head. And I would love to actually have like a 3D animation on my computer screen kind of showing how it's changing from one form to another. Get an idea for which parts of the bone are being changed when it has to, you know, go from being a flared plate to a steep bowl or something for the pelvis. And so I have this idea that I want to get involved, or I want to talk to some animators or something, maybe. I don't even know who you go to talk to about this, in terms of actually modeling how different species were walking and what they were doing and just making this a lot easier, where in the past you really had to have like a whole art department and, you know, only documentaries would be able to afford to do this kind of thing. And even then the models were stick figures and they weren't very robust. And so now I think we're getting to a point where everything's getting more visual, and I definitely think visually, and so I think it'll be really cool to see what our, you know, what our presentations 10 years from now end up looking like. I think they'll be filled with little walking around skeletons that will show us how the different parts fit together differently in different hominins. At least that's my hope.
I'm like picturing Nightmare Before Christmas, Tim Burton style.
Right, exactly. That'll be what paleoanthropology conferences are like.
That would be really entertaining.
I think so.
Just call up Tim Burton, suggest it to him.
Well, and also helpful in terms of being able to just visualize what the skeletons look like as whole things, as opposed to, it's really easy to focus in on one area and just be like, I'm just focused in on the pelvis. I totally don't remember what the spine looks like, kind of thing. And so it's good every now and then to step back and be like, right, there's a whole body here and it's kind of integrated.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, if you focus on studying the pelvis, could it be that, let's say, you're missing something if you had been looking at the hip bone that connects to it or something? And if you had
seen that bone, that would change everything. This I'm finding is actually my particular challenge, is that I keep doing these projects that focus on not just the pelvis, but like pelvic fragments. And so they're so tiny and so not associated with any other part of the skeleton. But the challenge is then taking that and learning something that will give you a better idea of the overall skeleton, because the pelvis, it's central to the body. It affects, you know, what the legs are going to look like. It affects what the torso is going to look like. It affects your posture, how you're going to stand, how you're going to walk, all of these different things. And so I really do think that you can't just look at it in a vacuum. You can't just look at the fragments. You have to think more big picture than that. And it's something I'm still working on figuring out the best way to do.
Thank you very much, Caroline, for joining us and letting us geek out over what it is that you do.
Yeah, thanks for talking with me. This is fun.
Like our show? Find out more at scopepodcast.com and follow us online on Facebook and Twitter at Scope Podcast. This is Lindsay Claiborne
and Mumu Shu.
Our theme music was composed by The Copycuts. Thanks for listening.